And hello, Sun Sal's listeners. This is Andy Bombick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the 2024 Newbery Award-winning novel that I've been reading now for about 3 months, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled, My Daddy is a Cowboy. And then it's Lala's Words. And then my all-time favorite picture book titled that I've read a number of times on the program, The Short and Incredibly Happy Life of Riley. The Night I Followed the Dog. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with a few of Aunt Maud's storybook, The Wallace and Ladmo Show Presents. All right, so it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled, My Daddy is a Cowboy. Daddy wakes me up before the sun, quietly because my little brother is still asleep, and so is Mommy. But Abuelita is awake. She always wakes up first. The strong smell of her coffee wafts through the house, just like every other morning. But today isn't like every other morning. It's different. Today, we get to ride together, just me and Daddy. Abuelita hands me a brown bag with apple slices. I say thank you and kiss her papery cheek goodbye. The sky is midnight black, and the stars are still twinkling. Everything is closed this early. All the stores are dark and empty. It feels like a different world than in the daytime, when things are bright and busy and full of life. It's a new kind of quiet. Anyone might confuse the ranch where the horses live for just a regular house. But in the backyard, there are stalls and stalls of horses. I run up to Power, Daddy's mare, and pet her soft, velvety black nose. After I feed Power the apple slices I brought, she noses my hand, hoping for more. But I'm saving the rest for Clover, the pony I ride. While Daddy gets Power's brushes, I tell Clover I'm happy to see her. She nuzzles my pockets, quick to sniff out the apple slices. I love the feeling of her mane. It looks kind of like the hay she eats, but feels softer. I bet she's wondering why I'm here so early. Daddy says we're riding early so that we can have just us time, and also so we don't have to worry about cars and trucks and things. Daddy usually rides around town on weekends with the other cowboys. I usually ride at the ranch after school with the other kids. But today we ride together, and today I get to ride on the street like a cowboy. And if I'm lucky, people will see us ride and will make them smile like the cowboys do when they ride around town. We brush and saddle Power and Clove together. I gather all the tack and hand Daddy each piece. I know the right order because I've been practicing. We're always gentle with our horses. Daddy says cowboys respect horses. I respect horses, and I'm grateful that they let us ride. Daddy's strong arms lifts me right onto Clover's back. Then, quick as a wink, Daddy is on Power, and we ride out onto the street. Now the sky is deep ocean blue instead of midnight black. Most houses are dark and still, but a few have lights on. Their windows look like they have stars shining behind their curtains. Early birds, Daddy says, and we laugh together, imagining birds living inside the houses, tweeting softly to each other. We pass my favorite Pandaria, and the sky is like the layered cakes they have there. Dark blue at the top, lighter blue in the middle, and just turning golden on the horizon. We pass Mommy's favorite coffee shop and the place where Abuelita sends money to her sister, who lives in the city where they grew up in Panama. We ride slowly through the neighborhood, and Daddy tells me cowboy stories in his quiet voice. I have to ride closer to hear him. Daddy's voice is deep, but never loud. I listen closely and only interrupt 5 times to ask questions. Daddy started riding when he was my age. The cowboys he rides with on the weekends are the same ones he learned to ride with when he was little. They've been friends forever, and Daddy's been riding Power for most of that time. I whisper thank you to Power for carrying Daddy for so many years. Daddy says riding helped him feel stronger, safer, and happier. I know what Daddy means because I feel that way when I ride. Tall, high as the clouds, strong as a horse's back, like a cowboy. I look up at the sky. It's getting lighter. It's swirly sherbet colors now, pink, yellow, orange, and still some blue. Our town is waking up. Some stores are open now, their windows wide eyes looking out on the day. A few people drive by. They point and smile and wave. Cowboys are famous around here. They make people happy. I wave back and sit a little straighter in my saddle. Daddy winks at me, and I smile. I love bringing smiles to people's faces, just like cowboys do. Clover is steady and keeps trotting along. But I can tell Power likes to be admired. She tosses her black mane and neighs, showing off. When we get back to the ranch, a few other cowboys stream into the yard. They all call greetings and wave. I know each of them and their horses, too. The day is just starting for them, but for me, the best part has already happened. Daddy and I drive back home so he can drop me off before his regular Saturday morning ride with the other cowboys. People walk the streets, and there are more cars and bikes on the road. The sky is blue and light enough that I can see wispy clouds. When we get home, I give Daddy a hug and a big kiss on the cheek. His beard is scratchy, but I don't mind. I say, thank you, gracias. He smiles and asks what my favorite part was. I take a minute to think about it. Was it the feel of Power's velvety nose? Or Clover's hay silk mane? Was it the changing sky colors? Or the early morning quiet? All of those things were great. But I know what my favorite was, just us time, I answer, and Daddy hugs me tight. My daddy is a cowboy, and so am I. Layla's words. Hot, hot, hot. The sidewalks steamed, and the sun hung heavy in the sky. Everyone was still. Layla was not. Layla jumped and ran, tripped and fell. Layla was sweaty and her clothes always torn. Layla, stay still, her mother said. What child is as rough as you? Layla didn't know, but she did know she liked to go outside. Past Mr. Patek with his radio, around the corner, down the block, over the fence, in a patch of dirt and concrete, grew short green weeds and leaves. A place of Layla's own. "Hello. Hello, friends," Layla whispered. Every morning, Layla ran to her garden. Through the heat, she carried a pot of water, but it was her kind words that made the plants sway and nod. "You are stripy and lovely," said Layla. "Stop playing with weeds and leaves. You're covered in dirt," cried her mother. "Grow strong and tall, my friends," said Layla. "Be still and quiet," said her mother. "You are so very special," sighed Layla. On the hottest day of summer, Layla's mother had enough. "No more, Layla, no more jibber-jabber and dirt and grass. Today, you are staying at home." Layla cried and cried. Who would visit her little friends? So Layla stayed inside, out from the melting heat. From the window, she counted buses wheezing past, listened to Mr. Petit come with his radio, and waved politely when Rosie passed by with her groceries. Throughout the day, she whispered softly, "Hello, hello, friends." At night, the moon rose like a bright eye. Out her window, Layla whispered to her plants, "Good night, my friends. I love you very much." The next morning, the sun didn't burn so strong. It was cool, 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 and breezy under a great big shade. Hector was the first to see. When he looked out his window, he whistled long and hard. Well, look at that. Layla's friends had grown strong and tall. So strong and tall, they covered Layla and her neighbors like a fountain under the sun. They had been listening every day that summer. So deeply they listened to Layla's words, they had come to find her through the warm night air. "Magnificent, my magnificent friends," cried Layla. Layla ran down the stairs. Her mother was staring out the door. "Oh, Layla, you are so very special." Her mother held her close and tight, and Layla felt warm inside. "I love you, my amazing girl. Go out and play." And Layla did. And it shows a picture of the town, and the town is just covered in plants. And now I'm going to read my all-time favorite picture book that I've read many, many times over the years. That's titled The Short and Incredibly Happy Life of Riley. Everyone wants to live forever. They want to be happy and healthy. Some of these things are actually quite difficult, but some of them are really easy, which might seem surprising because most people hardly manage any of them, at least not all of the time. None of this bothered Riley. Okay, you have to know that Riley is a rat. Riley had been born happy. His earliest memory was being with his brothers and sisters and mom in a big bed with plenty of food and no rain. He was always happy, even when he was asleep. He was beautiful and everyone loved him. He was the best, and so were his brothers and sisters and mom. All Riley wanted was some fruit and maybe a couple of slugs on Tuesday or Friday or now and then. People, of course, want more than that, which is a shame because it's about all you need, apart from a cup of tea and some toast and maybe not the slug. People want double fudge, chocolate, caviar, sausage, gourmet jumbo size, baby, cow, sheep, chicken, with extra thick whipped cream and MSG sauce burgers, some of which is gross, some cruel, and most unhealthy. All Riley wanted was a little stick with a pointy end to scratch the bit of his back he couldn't reach himself. People, of course, want more than that. They want microwave, video, DVD, SMS, internet, big car, cost more than yours, gold, diamond, electronic, gigabyte, fastest, biggest, and smallest machines. People, of course, should never be allowed to have sticks with pointy ends because they stick them into each other. Riley looked into the mirror and didn't think anything. There he was, not too big, not too small, simply himself, Riley. People look in the mirror and get very depressed. They want to be taller, shorter, thinner, here, but much bigger there, curly, straight, younger, older, less spotty, mustache, smooth skin, golden suntan, gorgeous, irresistible, not bald, and famous in a painting. The only place Riley ever wanted to be was here, which he always was. People, of course, want to be everywhere. They want to go to the seaside ski resort, paradise dream, world castaway exclusive, you must really be rich if you can afford to come here, plaza luxury, get away from it, all, anywhere, but here, theme park. Riley fell in love with the first girl he met. He thought she was perfect and the most beautiful girl he had ever seen. They had lots and lots of perfect children and all lived happily ever after except Kevin, who got hit by a bus, but was still happy because he never saw it coming. People fall in love all over the place. They fall in love with themselves and as many other people as they can. They want to spend the rest of their lives, for at least a month, with the most beautiful, funniest, curviest, clever, but not as clever as me, exciting, I wonder what I ever saw in him, slash her, my wife, husband, partner, dog, doesn't understand me, do you come here often, anyone, everyone in the world. And one of the silly things about life is that people who spend so much time not eating what they really want, in places where they don't want to be, with people they don't like, usually live for quite a long time. Whereas Riley, who spends all the time eating his favorite food, in his favorite place, with his favorite friends, only lives for a very short time. This is why it's never a good idea for people to compare their lives to animals. You will only end up feeling depressed. Because realizing that rats have a better life than you do is really, really sad. And the answer is very simple. You just have to be happy with a lot less. Release your inner Riley. The night I followed the dog. I have a dog, nothing exotic or special, just an ordinary dog. In fact, I always thought he was a boring dog. What I mean is, well, he can fetch, roll over, and shake hands, but mostly he sleeps and eats. I used to think that our next door neighbors had the best dog in the world. Their dog can sing and change the channels on the TV. Their dog always wins medals in obedience school. But I don't think their dog is so great now, not since the night I followed my dog. Every night I let my dog out, and he runs off into the darkness with his tail wagging. The next morning I let him in, and he heads straight for the food bowl. One morning I knew something was funny when I opened the door a little bit earlier than usual, and I saw my dog jump out of a limousine, wearing a tuxedo. Before I could look twice, he disappeared into the backyard. I opened the kitchen door and whistled. When he came into the house, he was the same as he always is, hungry. I really wasn't sure that I believed what I had seen, so that night I decided to follow him. I wore dark clothing, so I wouldn't be noticed, and I left my bicycle near the door, so I'd have it close by. When I let the dog out, I slipped out too. I took out the garbage so he wouldn't suspect anything. The dog went straight to his doghouse. I saw a light go on inside. Slowly, I snuck around the backyard and peeked into the doghouse. This was not the doghouse that I had helped build. Inside, there was a living room, a bathroom, and a huge closet full of fancy clothes. The dog was in the bathroom. He was wearing a tuxedo and fumbling with the bow tie. When he came out, he casually walked out of the doghouse, across the yard, and down the street. I grabbed my bicycle and followed him. Two blocks later, I saw a limousine pull over. The dog got in, and the car took off. I started pedaling faster. The car headed across town. I thought I would lose them, but luckily, they were stopped by a few lights. After a while, I found myself in a part of town that I had never seen before. The buildings all seemed to be empty, and it was very quiet. The limousine stopped. I hid and watched my dog get out. He disappeared into a building, and the limousine pulled away. There was nothing on the outside of the building, just two brass fire hydrants on either side of the entrance. I opened the door. At the end of the hall, there was a neon sign that said, "The Dog House." I crept closer. It looked like some kind of club. I decided to get a closer look. The moment I opened the door, two mean-looking bulldogs appeared and said, "You can't come in here." I didn't know what to say, so I said, but I saw my dog. I mean, I think my dog's in here." Just then, my dog walked over and said, "It's okay, boys. He's with me." The bulldog said, "Sure, boss. Whatever you say, boss." For a minute, that seemed like forever. I waited. Then my dog said, "Yeah, I knew you would find out eventually. Well, now you know. This is my place." I looked around. Finally, I asked, "What is this place?" My dog said, This is a place where dogs come after a hard day. It's a place we can relax. It's a place where we can talk about our problems with the mailman or with the poodle next door. See all the sofas? We can sit on the sofas here. We can get treats without having to lie down, roll over, or play dead. And if we want to chew on a shoe or chase our tail, no one will stop us. We have no masters here, no leashes, and no rolled-up newspapers. This is a place where dogs can be dogs. We sat down. A cocker spaniel came by and asked me if I would like a bowl of water or some biscuits. Little by little, dogs of all kinds started coming in. Some danced. Some talked. They all looked at me a little funny, but when they saw who I was with, they smiled and shook my hand. At one point, my dog waved to an Afghan with a camera. She came over to our table and took a picture of us together. Being with my dog made me feel like a movie star. Just when I was really starting to enjoy myself, I looked at my watch. I told my dog I had to leave or I'd get in trouble. He nodded. I think he was about to say something, but a glamorous greyhound grabbed his paw and whisked him onto the dance floor. As he was getting up, he tossed me the photo of the two of us. Then He bowed slightly and disappeared into the crowd. Well, it was way past my bedtime. As I pedaled home into the cool night, I thought to myself, now I'm really going to be in the doghouse. But then again, that might not be so bad. Okay, I'm going to end up the first half hour of today's program with some fables taken from the book, The Waltz and Ladmo Show Presents Aunt Maud's Storybook. The Ants and the Termites. For weeks and weeks, all the ants in the forest were building a new ant hill. They worked hard and minded their own business. Right next to the ant hill, there was a big tree. All the termites in the forest were eating that tree. They called down to the ants, "Go away, ants. You're building your ant hill too close to our tree." The ants called back, "Go chew on another tree. We're staying right where we are." Well, both sides recalled their ambassadors. It looked like war. Both sides prepared for battle. But then, at the last minute, a truce was called. The ants and the termites decided to share the tree and the anthill between them. They signed a treaty. The war was called off. There was peace in the forest. Next day, a lumberjack came along and chopped down the tree. The tree fell over and flattened the ant hill and everything in it. Kenny and Kathy go to the country. Once upon a time, Kenny and Kathy went to the country to visit their grandparents. What a nice vacation. The sun was shining. Kenny and Kathy picked berries and Grandma baked a pie. Grandpa took them to the barn and the chicken coop. He said, "You can play anywhere you want. The fields, the orchards, the streams, anywhere but the haunted house." "What haunted house?" Kenny and Kathy wanted to know. "The one at the end of the lane," answered Grandpa. "Don't go near there because of the ghost." "We're not afraid of ghosts," they replied. Late that night, Kenny and Kathy slipped out of their grandparents' cottage and went down the lane to the haunted house. It was old and dark and boarded up. "Isn't this exciting?" whispered Kenny. "Let's go inside," said Kathy. They pried open a side door and went inside. It was very dark. The floor creaked. All of a sudden, there was a rush of wind and an eerie shriek. Kenny and Kathy started screaming. It was pitch black, and they couldn't find their way out. All the neighbors for miles around heard them shouting and yelling for help, but it was too late. There was nothing anyone could do. Kenny and Kathy were never heard from again, and Grandma and Grandpa had a hard time explaining to Kenny and Kathy's parents what had happened. But the advance on the movie rights helped ease the pain somewhat, especially after Grandpa was signed for a cameo role. The Rabbit and the Bear. Once upon a time, there was a bear who kept picking on this rabbit. Every time they would pass in the hall, the bear would shove the rabbit for no reason at all. The rabbit always minded his own business and never started any trouble. But every day, the bear would push him around. At first, the rabbit tried to laugh it off, but it kept happening. After a while, the rabbit got fed up and decided to do something about it. He knew the bear was much bigger, but he couldn't put up with it any longer. So one day, he got a big stick and waited for the bear to appear. Pretty soon, the bear came down the hallway. The rabbit jumped out with the stick and started to swing. The bear took the stick away and broke it over the rabbit's head. The rabbit was treated for a mild concussion and left town immediately. And for a couple of years, there was an Easter bear until they found another rabbit for the job. When a young brave grows up, Indian legend has it that when a young brave reached the age of 12, he was taken to the mountains and left alone. This ritual was his test of manhood. If he found his way home, he passed the test. One such boy was Falling Rocks, nephew of Bouncing Boulders, and cousin of Sitting Stones. When Facing Rocks reached his 12th birthday, he was taken to the mountains and left there. Weeks passed, months passed, and he was never heard from again. To this day, there are signs along the highway, through the mountains, that say, "Watch for Falling Rocks." If they ever do find him, he's in big trouble for failing the test. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the Newbery 2024 Newbery Award-winning book that I've been reading now close to 3 months, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Johannes is a free dog, a fast dog, such a fast dog. He lives in an urban park by the sea, and every day he runs through the park, seeing all, missing nothing, and reporting what he sees to the park's three ancient bison, the keepers of the equilibrium. But the equilibrium has been disrupted. Mysterious rectangles are hypnotizing Johannes. The humans are erecting a mysterious new building, and an entirely new kind of animal has arrived in the park. And there are hundreds of them. Johannes must run faster, see better, and ultimately do more than run and see. He must liberate those he loves. Okay, this is what we learned last week. After talking to the goat with strange horns, Johannes ran back to his house inside a tree, which is now a wall of cement. Johannes ran back to Helen, that's the goat, who told him that she's seen bison on the plains near Snowy Mountains. He talked to Helen every day, who told him things he didn't know about because she lived off the island they were now living on. Johannes calls the sun she and thinks the sun is a god. Helen isn't so sure. A couple other goats show up and call Helen strange stripes. Well, the two goats apologize for their bad behavior to Johannes because they thought Johannes was a goat herder dog. And that's where I left off last week. I am a dog. You know this. So when these two goats saw me, they snapped in line. They bowed down. They were ready to obey, which meant that the rest of the goats would do the same. I didn't need them to snap in line or bow down or anything like that. But to have them treat Helen with dignity, I had that power. There are times in this life when I have been surprised by the words I say, the words that I should be wholly aware of and in control of, but sometimes they seem to be channeled from some other place, from the sky, from the past, from a nobler version of myself. And such a group of words came from my mouth at that moment. I said, "You disappoint me." I said this to the cruel goats who were sneering and snickering at my friend Helen. And then I stared at them for a very long time. Oh, the looks in their eyes. It was something like terror, something like apology, something like shame. "We are sorry," one of them said. "We are embarrassed," the other said. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Helen. Her eyes were 1,000 times bigger than before. She couldn't believe what she was seeing and hearing. "I think you can do better," I said to the goats, and immediately they nodded so vigorously I feared their heads would fall from their necks. "Thank you, sir," one said, "for taking the time to educate us." "And for your faith in us," said another. And then I went further, and even while saying these next words, I worried I was going far too far. Henceforth, among your kind, there will be no differentiation based on tiny deviations of physical form. There will be no snickering based on things like the sort of cross stripes one of you has or doesn't have, or the directions one fur goes, or the color of your eyes or hooves. Such behavior is an affront to the dignity of your species. Is that understood? The two goats before me nodded gravely, and I looked beyond them to see that a crowd of other goats had heard, too, and were fixed in place, grave agreements in their eyes. I couldn't think of anything else to say, so I said, "Now go forth and eat some weeds." Chapter 27. The next day, after we woke up, and after Helen had spent 100 or so hours eating, her eyes brightened. "I almost forgot to tell you," she said. "In the middle of the night, I had an idea for you." The sun had recently risen with her billion golden arms, and I will admit that I worried Helen would tell me unsettling ideas about the sun not being God. I worried Helen would tell me that ants were God, or mushrooms, or some other upside-down notion, but instead she had a question that was very good, and an idea that was even better. "You were saying yesterday that you were planning to free the bison," she said. "But where will you bring them once they're free of their fencing?" This I didn't know. It was one of the things I hadn't worked out. Well, the farthest I'd taken the plan was to the sea. I kept picturing them on the sand, running free, and that's where the dream ended. And I told her so. "Hmm," she said, and looking out to the rolling ocean. "Well, I'm so grateful to you for sticking up for me with the other goats. I can't tell you how grateful." So I was up half the night thinking of how to repay you. I told her it was wholly unnecessary that she repay me. She grinned. "I knew you would say that," she said. "But anyway, in the middle of the night, I had a thought. Why not bring the bison on the ship back to the mainland, where we'll go? There's more than enough room for all the bison in the world. There's a billion miles where they can run and graze and sleep and even hide if they need to. The land never ends. I've lived there all my life and haven't seen even a tiny part of it." Immediately, this idea seemed a perfect one to me. An idea so flawless and inevitable, I knew we had to make it real. But would the ship really be big enough? How would the bison not be seen and expelled? "Good question," she said. "It'll be tricky because they're so large. I assume your bison pals are large?" I confirmed to Helen that they were very large. "Well," she said, "the thought I had was that maybe they could mix in with all of us, especially if we were jumping around on each other's backs, which we do sometimes. And when we all tramp up the gangway onto the ship, your bison friends could sneak in there among us, and maybe they wouldn't get noticed." Helen closed her eyes as if picturing it. She nodded at the sight in her mind. "Well, it's an idea anyway." Now she looked out at the innumerable goats of all colors, and I did too. I wondered if the bison could possibly blend in among them. There were some larger goats, but even the largest among them was less than half the size of Meredith, the smallest of the bison. But we could work on it, I thought. "Well, it'll take a lot of planning, 100 years of planning, but I know it'll work." I told her she was quite brilliant. and told her I was very grateful and told her that tomorrow I would tell the assistant eyes about the plan, and if they liked it, a few days later, I would tell the Bison, and then we would begin drawing up schemes. I was going on, and that's when Helen stopped me. "Oh, we don't have 100 years to plan this," she said. "We don't even have 100 days or 100 hours. The boat leaves tomorrow morning at 7:08. Chapter 28. And then I was running. I was running because there was little time to plan all of this, make all of this happen. And I was running because at that moment I couldn't look at Helen. She was my new and very good friend, a friend who opened my mind and filled it with new treasures, and now she was leaving. The thought hit me like a 1,000-foot-tall wave with all its chaos and cruelty. But more important than my sadness about losing this friend was the possibility and inevitability of freeing the Bison. Helen's plan was the most sparkling and logical and inspiring plan we could ever conjure. And so I ran to spread the word. In my history of running fast, this was far and away the fastest I have been. I pierced the air like a knife thrown. I bent the trees. I created a vacuum that threatened to suck the clouds from the sky. I ran to gather the assistants for an emergency meeting and succeeded in seconds. I told everyone to meet me at the top of the rock, and they hustled to do just this. Everyone but Bertrand. I could not find Bertrand. But we could not wait. I assumed he would hear or would fly over and find us soon enough. In the meantime, we needed to move ahead. 7:08, I said to Angus. Is this something related to time? Helen said, that's when the ship leaves. Yes, Angus said with great seriousness and pride in his time-telling. That means the morning, not long from now. I told the assistant eyes that all the vague plans we'd made to free the Bison would have to move up, would have to come into sharp focus immediately. We'd have to plan and practice all day and night and be ready to free them at dawn to get them on the boat well before this 7:08. It was the only way. This was our first and last chance to set them free. Not just free to run on the beach for a moment, but free forever. That is a lot to take in, Angus said. My brain is vibrating, Yolanda said. I like it, Sonia said. I think it can work. I was surprised by Sonia's confident tone, and everyone else was too. I don't think anyone was doubting that we should free them, or that this was a good opportunity to do that, but Sonia was the first to give this new and precious chance momentum. We need to start now, she said. I loved her for that. Sometimes in this life, so much depends on one friend simply saying, yes, we must do this, or yes, I see it that way too, or is it high time we do something great and grand? Now with that simple statement, the fact of us doing this, of freeing the Bison the next morning, became real. Now it was just a matter of directing every fiber of our being and every moment from now till then to the task. So it was easy, but also not so easy. It was one of those instances where it's so complicated that it's simple, because we knew how complicated it would be, and that idea was simple enough. I said all this to the assistants, and they looked at me with blank stares. I realized that when I'd shared this notion with Bertrand, it had made perfect sense. Anyway, Angus said, we have less than 24 hours. Everyone's stares were still blank, but this blankness was now directed at Angus, not me, for which I was grateful. Less than a day, he clarified, and we went to work. I had wanted to make sure the assistants agreed with the plan before I brought it to the bison, and now I felt ready. I came to their enclosure and found them surrounded by humans, more than I had ever seen in the midst before. Some I recognized, some I didn't. There were 10 or more. They had equipment, tools, pools, ropes, little silver discs, and little black boxes. What were they doing? I couldn't get close. Something about the bison being surrounded by humans with their tools made me all the more determined to set them loose. And so the rest of the daylight hours were busy with the assistants and me meeting and planning and convincing. With Angus, we convinced the raccoons to help, which wasn't very difficult, for they liked nothing better than mischief at the expense of humans. And honestly, I think they were happy to shift the focus from the museum break-in plan, which they never loved. With Yolanda's help, we met with the pelicans, 20 or more of them, to work out their role, mostly one of observation and possible misdirection. She also gathered the gulls, who were skeptical about the feasibility of the plan, but who agreed to go along. There is something about an urgent task that unites and inspires. No one said no to us, except, of course, the ducks. It was Sonia's idea to ask the ducks. I had insisted there was no point, and Angus and Yolanda agreed. There was nothing ducks could do that gulls could not do. So why ask the ducks in the first place? Why risk them mucking up the plan, as only ducks can do? Yolanda and Agnes would not take part in the asking of the ducks. Exasperated, they went off to clear their heads. And there we were, Sonia and me, with the ducks, standing on the edge of their smelly pond as they swam about, barely paying attention to us. When finally they noticed us standing at the water's edge, waiting to be noticed, one of them swam over. "Hey, what's all this about?" said this one, their leader. His name was Jerome. I told him that we planned to free the bison. "Who are the bison?" said another duck. That's one's name was Jerry. All the ducks' names start with a J. It's one of the many, many upsetting things about the ducks. Not that there's anything wrong with this J sound. It's a fine sound. But all animals of a species should not have to adhere to one starting letter. It's a bad form, against all the laws of nature and good taste. Anyway, we explained who the bison were. I don't know how the ducks did not know who the bison were, but nothing about the ducks surprised me. "So what did you say you're doing with them?" Jerome asked. "We're freeing them," I said. "From what?" "They're not free," Jerome said. "No, they're stuck inside a fence," we told him. Jerome's head was suddenly underwater, so I didn't know if he heard me or not. He popped up again, but then Jerry's head went under. "Tell me again, when is this happening?" Jerome asked. "Early tomorrow morning," I said. "Oh, the morning is a busy time for us," he said, and ducked his head underwater again. Jerry reappeared. "Oh, very busy," he said. "We have to swim in the morning and periodically put our heads underwater. This is key." And he popped his head underwater. But Jerome was back. "Such a busy time," Jerome said. Another duck's head popped out of the smelly green water. "What are we talking about?" she asked. This one's name was Jackie. "These guys want to free the squirrels," Jerome told her. "Not the squirrels," I said, "the bison." "Why would they want to free the squirrels?" Jackie asked. "The squirrels seem pretty free to me." "Bison," I said. "We're trying to free the bison." "Bison?" Jerome said. And those, the big guys inside, are those the big guys inside the fence? Who says they want to be free? We did, and they did, I said. I tried to explain that their wanting to be free was not part of the debate, that we were actually hoping to get the ducks' help in freeing them. But they continued to jabber among themselves. Why wouldn't they just fly over the fence? Jackie asked. I don't think they can fly, Jerome said. Sure they can, Jackie insisted. I see them flying all the time. They are white and fluffy and fly sort of slowly. Oh, right, Jerome said. I think you're talking about clouds, Jerry said. No, we're talking about squirrels, Jackie said. Bison, Jerome corrected. What are we talking about again? Said a fourth duck, this one named Jeremiah. My beak is itchy. And at that, we felt it was time to leave. We turned away, and I heard one of the ducks say, Who was that? The answer was, No idea. When we were out of earshot, I told Sonia we should not have asked the ducks. No serious plan ever involves ducks. Finally, she agreed, though she seemed bewildered and disappointed that the ducks could not be inspired. But we did need the rats, the crows, and the horses, so we made arrangements with all of them, and to the last creature, they were excited about the plan and about freeing the bison, and were quite happy to do it as soon as possible. After all our gathering and planning, I was so tired I needed some time at the top of the rock for air and contemplation. Don't worry, Sonia said. She had come up next to me. This time, she'd approached with confidence, with directness, without any of the shyness I'd known her for. I have to say, the transformation was remarkable, and I was very proud of her. Even her busted eye looked better. It seemed to have turned itself into a handsome scar, a dignified thing. We're making good progress, she said. I even think the ducks will surprise you in the end. I think everyone has a role to play. I sighed the loudest sigh of my life, again, with the ducks. And also, she said, you know, there's been talk about who will oversee things in the park when the bison are gone. I hadn't had time to think about this. Yes, when the bison were gone, they would leave a void, a rather large one. Some group or someone would have to step in and become the leader, the overseer, the keeper of the equilibrium. Well, it could be you, Sonia said. Think of it. You're already the closest to the bison. You know all that they know. In fact, you've delivered all the information they have. So it just seems natural that you'd take over when they're gone. This I hadn't thought of. In fact, never in 10,000 years would I have thought of such a thing. Me, as the keeper of the equilibrium? Sonia must have seen the astonishment on my face. But who else could it be, she asked. And though I was flattered to be thought of this way and could see the logic given my proximity to the bison, all I could think of was Bertrand. He was the one I went to for wisdom. Could I be keeper of the equilibrium when I looked to someone else for guidance? I thought about this as we crisscrossed the park, making our final arrangements for the bison's escape. There were routes to clear. There were animals to warn. There were humans to count. There were distractions to design. And there were goats to engage. Chapter 29. I had made a plan with Helen to talk to the goats once their day was done. It was just before sunset when I went to the windmill and found them all still eating, their heads down and jaws churning. Helen led me to a hill overlooking the field of flowers and weeds. though the weeds were nearly gone. Not one of the goats looked up. "Just bark," Helen said. "Bark?" I asked. "Do you know how to bark?" she asked. "Usually the dogs will bark." I had only barked a few times in my life. Being the eyes required speed and stealth, and barking eliminated both, really. Barking brought attention to oneself and slowed one down considerably. You can't run so fast while barking. Not everyone knows that. But I understood her meaning. I needed to make some sound so the goats would take notice. And only a few of them had seen me, ever. So I figured a very loud first impression might be in order. "Yip," I said. Or I thought I said yip. But even Helen, who was standing next to me, didn't seem to hear it. The wind from the ocean was strong, so I thought my yip had gotten lost in the offshore breeze. I tried another yip, this one louder. This time, Helen took notice, but also smiled a painted sort of smile, as if to tell me my yip was more like a yip. I had to do much, much better. I decided to just go big and bark. So I sucked the wind from the ocean, and I ate the clouds from the sky, and I looked to the sun and gathered from her all the strength she had to give. And I roared a kind of bark that was also a howl and also a bellow and even a bit of a squall. I had my eyes closed as I unleashed it, and when it ended, I opened my eyes to find 1,000 goat heads and 2,000 goat eyes looking up at me, terrified. I had no idea what to say to them. But Helen did. "In the morning," she whispered to me. "In the morning," I roared, "we will engage in a heroic act," Helen whispered. "We will engage in a heroic act," I roared. Already, I saw that these were the right words. The goats, who I took to be only interested in eating prickly leaves, seemed very interested in the words heroic act. "We will cloak and free 3 animal captives," Helen whispered. "We will cloak and free 3 animal captives," I roared. I repeated her words for a bit, and soon enough, I had gained confidence and momentum enough to lay out the plan. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I'm going to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.